There is a moment from the Oscars on Sunday night that I'd like to unpack. Matthew Cherry's acceptance speech for Hair Love, which won Best Animated Short Film for its portrayal of a family learning to honor and love their natural hair. The former NFL player thanked the people who worked on the movie, and then he said this.
We wanted to see more representation in animation. We wanted to normalize black hair. There's a very important issue that's out there. It's the Crown Act. And if we can help to get this passed in all 50 states, it will help stories like DeAndre Arnold, who's our special guest tonight, stop to happen.
DeAndre Arnold is a Texas teen whose high school told him he couldn't walk in his graduation ceremony if he didn't cut his dreads off. And the Crown Act would prohibit employers and schools from making rules like that against traditionally black hairstyles. Kansas is one of the states debating that law now. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about hair discrimination on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. My first guest is Michelle Whatley. She's played a big role in getting political traction for the Crown Act in Kansas. Hi, Michelle.
Good morning. How are you, Gina?
I'm good. How are you?
I am good. Happy to be here.
You have evoked the name Patrick Mahomes in your arguments. You've said that Mahomes didn't need to straighten his hair to win the Super Bowl.
Yes, clearly. He has a mane full of curls, a crown of glory that got us all the way to the Super Bowl and led to a big win. And when we think about all of the excitement around his hair and seeing people wear the caps with the Mahomes hair and all the Mahomes hair love, we get excited about that. Even cakes.
Made to look like they have his hair.
Made to look like they have his hair. But if Patrick Mahomes worked in certain workspaces or went to certain schools, he might find that he would have to straighten or cut his hair in order to graduate, in order to attend school, in order to keep his job.
How did the Crown Act first come to your attention?
Well, I am actually friends with the legislator who passed the initiative in New York. California was the first state to pass it, the Crown Act, and New York was the second. And so when I saw that she was able to work this legislation, I thought that not only was it an important issue, it's an important issue here in the Midwest for black women across the region, and I thought it would be an issue that black women across the region, regardless of their political affiliation, economic status, education level, we've all dealt with this issue at one point in our lives or another. And so it became an issue we needed to take up.
Talk to me about that. What spoke to you about it personally?
Well, when I think about my own journey, I started off as a carpenter in construction. I worked with Local 61, the Carpenters Union here in Kansas City, for a number of years and wore braids the entire time I was in that industry. And when I decided to go to college and pursue a different career in communications, I found that I was having to either get weaves or regularly straighten my natural hair in order to fit into communications and political spaces.
What sent you the message that you needed to do that? Where did you perceive that message? Can you talk me through that?
Yeah, that's a message that I think is ingrained in all black women and men, that a standard of professionalism includes straightened hair, hair that is straightened, pulled back, and essentially goes against the very natural way that my hair grows out. I don't wake up in the morning with straightened hair. I have to go through arduous processes to get my hair straightened, whether it's relaxers or hot combs. And so coming into a new workspace in a new industry, I had to, you know, make these decisions on a regular basis. If I was going on a job interview, I knew I'd have to pay to straighten my hair. If I was getting a new position, I'd have to straighten my hair. If I was meeting someone of influence, I'd have to straighten my hair.
I want to acknowledge that both the Kansas Chamber of Commerce and the Kansas Association of School Boards think that the law, the Crown Act, is unnecessary. And the stated reason for some groups opposing it is the idea that there are jobs where various hairstyles aren't permitted due to safety, so like firefighters. And they're basically calling on people to show common decency instead of writing this into law. What are your thoughts about that?
I was surprised to hear that the Kansas Chamber oppose the bill. But when you look at the makeup of leadership, for instance, of the Kansas Chamber, there's only one person of color. There are no people of color on staff. And so I think it becomes more of an issue of education and understanding. And when you don't have anyone around you who has had this experience, it feels like an experience that is unnecessary, doesn't happen. there have been plenty of national stories and tons of research that shows that people are on a regular basis being discriminated against and turned away, all because of hairstyles that are cultural and natural to people. And so maybe there's an opportunity to educate these folks on the fact that this is not only an issue, it's an issue that impacts businesses. When you're turning away qualified candidates in a job market where it's hard to find reliable workers and reliable help, you're only hurting your business and the economic growth of the state of Kansas. I always think of Tyree Bayan, for instance, the young man that went to get a job at Cool Crest and was turned away because of his dreads. The manager said that he was a 100% qualified candidate. I imagine it's hard to find good teenage help or qualified candidates for a job at Cool Crest, but you missed out on having a great employee who was 100% qualified all because of a hairstyle. I mean, employers lose when Black people lose also because of these rules and regulations.
I want to focus now not on the law, but on the issue it seeks to address, hair discrimination more generally, and what you could call its opposite, the exact name of the movie that won an Oscar,
yes.
Hair Love. Were you excited to see that movie get the Oscar for Best Animated Short Film?
Of course. And who wouldn't be? It's a wonderful film. And it is a wonderful embodiment and expression of the love that Black people have for their hair. And hair for us is not just something that grows out of the top of our head. Hair is not only attached to our identity as far as race, it is cultural, it is political. When you look at the political movements and civil rights movements in the 60s and 70s, hair and the expression of Black hair in its natural form in afros was a political statement. So it becomes more than just something, again, that grows out of the top of our head. It is the luscious coils that wrap around themselves to create styles and expression that we as Black people are the only ones, like, essentially that can have that. I've never seen a white person with dreads. And when you see it, it is difficult to attain. And it's because
that's a lot of beeswax.
It's a lot of beeswax. But that's something that can happen for us naturally. And so it was a great ode to the love, creativity, and beauty of Black hair.
The movie depicts something very intimate, a young girl with brown skin trying to decide what she wants to do with her hair, considering straightening it, and ultimately really dreaming of a style that accentuates her natural hair. Her dad is the one who has to carry out her vision, and he is totally lost. For anyone who has not seen it, I'm not going to spoil the ending, but this family wrestling with the challenges and then overcoming them because they want this crown of glory, you know, as you've described it. It's really beautiful.
It is. And it's a decision that I think Black people, Afro-Latinos, have to grapple with on a regular basis. I've been natural for over 15 years, but most recently I was asked to join Ruckus, a KCPT television show that goes over the news of the day. And one of my first thoughts when I was telling a mentor that I had been selected for that was, I'm going to have to straighten my hair. Do I want to straighten my hair? Is that something I should do? Like, we had to have a whole discussion about that. And he reminded me of the beauty of my hair and what I contribute not only to the panel because of my expertise and my experiences, but what I contribute by my very presence and letting my natural hair be as it is and showcasing that on such a great platform.
Call 816-235-2888 with your story about how race and hair have affected you in your school, at your job, in organized sports, whatever. 816-235-2888. I want to take a call now from LaRon in Kansas City. Hi, LaRon.
Give me a second. Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Hey, I guess I didn't really have a question. I just have a statement. I've been doing hair in Kansas City for close to 25 years. So I've seen a lot of women with natural hair have to capitulate to make it straight for job interviews or just any type of social setting. And I just wanted to let the listening audience know that sometimes, you know, after years of doing this, it can cause damage.
Yes.
In most cases, it's irreversible damage.
Yes.
So I see a lot of young women in their 30s that are suffering from alopecia and permanent baldness. And it's a much bigger issue than a lot of people realize, because we're able to put the weaves and braids and wigs on to cover up the baldness. But it's a lot of women out there suffering from this.
Yeah, like there's an, like their bodies are harmed doing this. Is that what you're saying?
No, you know, it's something that you cannot reverse. You know, once the damage is done, it's done. And like I said, I see a lot of women in their 30s that are permanently bald. But, you know, again, we'll never know it because we're able to cover it up with wigs. But it's unfortunate that we have to do that to our hair and our scalp just to feel comfortable in today's society. And for my daughter, you know, I would never want her to have to feel like that. So I just wanted to kind of throw that out there, because a lot of people really don't understand what a lot of women go through with their hair.
Thank you so much, Lauren. Michelle, you are a mother, right?
I am not a mother.
Oh, sorry.
But I grew up as someone's daughter,
right,
and had to sit in the kitchen on Sundays and have my hair straightened with a pressing comb that reaches up to 450 degrees, the temperature of an oven, and experiencing the physical burns from having my scalp or ears touch. He brings up an excellent point. Hair relaxers essentially break down the hydrogen bond and chemical makeup of the hair strand and permanently alters the makeup of the hair strand. Chemical relaxers often cause burns between 1 and 3 degrees and lesions. Regular use of chemical relaxers have been found to increase the instance of fibroids in Black women and breast cancer. The undue burden and physical harm and risk is far outweighs trying to adhere to a Eurocentric standard of beauty that we cannot naturally meet and is narrow. I think of,
and not just beauty, but professionalism.
And professionalism, yes. When I think of Representative Presley, who recently came out and told her story of alopecia, I imagine a lot of that was due to hair stress and trauma from years of wearing wigs, weaves, braids that were worn to hide hair or create a professional look that has resulted in her now having hair loss, permanent hair loss. The undue burden is costly. It's timely. Weaves can be up to $400 to get installed and require regular maintenance. Relaxers require regular maintenance. If you straighten your hair, it requires even more maintenance, because if it gets moisture or wet, it reverts back to a curly pattern.
I'd like to invite a familiar voice to this discussion. Janae Osterhelt used to be a columnist for the Kansas City Star. She lives in Boston now. But for years, hair was part of an illustration that appeared beside her byline. Hi, Janae.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you? It's good to hear your voice.
Yours too.
I want to start with your own experience making choices about your own hair on kind of an intimate level, but also having to navigate what each decision would say about you publicly and professionally.
Well, excuse me. I think a lot of, like Michelle has touched on a lot of important topics and really hit a lot of keynotes. I did the big chop in 2002, so I've been natural for 18 years now. And when they first decided at the Kansas City Star they wanted to use an image of me, I didn't even want an image. A friend of mine who's an artist drew a cartoon of me, and it was with my very big curly afro and my huge hoop earrings and very exaggerated, identifiably Black features. And that ran for many years. And then when I went from a nightlife columnist to a anchor columnist, a culture columnist, they decided I needed an actual picture. And initially, the first picture of my hair might have been curly, and the second picture it was straight. And I straightened it initially not because I wanted to appear professional. It was because I was scared about how people treated me because I was Black with a voice in Kansas City. So I thought if my hair is straight, maybe they won't recognize me. Because there's this thing that happens when you are a Black woman and you straighten your hair. It's as if white people have seen you for the first time in their lives.
Explain
because
that.
When your hair is natural, when it's curly or braided or in Senegalese twist or locks, it's like they have decided you are an archetype of Blackness. So they don't even bother to look at your face. It's just your hair. You become Janae with the hair, or the person with the hair, or a Black body. When your hair is flat ironed, it's like, oh, they see your face because you suddenly look like one, like something familiar to them, mm-hmm. a standard of beauty that is normal in their eyes. I've had a number of people who I love, who worked with for years, who would say when my hair was straight, like, oh, I didn't even know that was you.
Will you?
And I know they don't think that's hurtful, but it's very hurtful because it says to me, like, oh, you don't even know what
hair.
I look like. Yeah.
Will you take us on your hair journey, if you can call it that? I have to assume it started before you became a columnist.
I've gone through, I think you can ask any Black girl woman, we all have different stories, but we all have a hair journey. My mom was a white woman, and she didn't know how to do my hair, which is a recurring story with a lot of Black biracial girls. And so I often had just a big head of curls that were allowed to do whatever they wanted. And as I got older, there were different things that happened. I had aunties that would braid my hair real tight. And then I had my mother's friends who were like, oh, relax her hair. And my dad didn't want me to get a relaxer. My mom relaxed it anyways. That was a thing. Then I cut it all off because I thought I could look like Halle Berry. And obviously none of us can. And and then by the time I got to college, throughout high school, I wore a lot of braids and finger waves and pin curls and styles that were very popular in hip hop culture at the time. And in college is when I started wearing my natural curls. Janet Jackson wore them on the cover of Velvet Rope, and it gave me the confidence to sort of really embrace my hair. But I still found myself flat ironing my hair whenever I would go see my mother and sister because they're white and I wanted to kind of look like them. And it was this weird insecurity, like not wanting to stand out as the Black girl in the family. Like, oh, well, if I flat iron my hair, then I can kind of just sort of at least fit in a little. And plus I knew not my family actually didn't react to me this way, but the outside white world reacted to me more kindly when my hair was straight. Like when I worked at J. Crew and I had my big curly hair, a white man specifically told one of the cashiers, the girl with the big bird's nest on her head helped me. And he was literally referring to my afro, and it was just so hurtful. And I had encountered that type of behavior so many times that it had sort of created this insecurity within me. And then, you know, in my 20s, I got really more accepting of myself and just loved my hair for what it is. And now I wear it curly all the time. And even when it comes to straightening my hair, when I flat iron my hair, I'm at a point now where I know I'm flat ironing it because it's just a style, not because I'm trying to look or be like anything else. I used to go to Laurent's salon. So Laurent, if you're listening, hi. I went to his salon, and I also went to Trey Smith. But yeah, like there's damage that can be done to our hair. You know, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, she has alopecia and she is bald, and she just took a stand and shared her hair journey. And the thing about Black women and our hair and Black men and their hair is the personal is political. And Ayanna Pressley talks about that a lot. She's one of the original co-sponsors with Cory Booker and Barbara Lee that introduced the Crown Act of 2019 as a federal bill, like not just the laws that have been passed in California, New York, and New Jersey. Like they are pushing this to be a federal bill.
Can I just jump in and say that it seems like there's no such thing as a neutral choice. And for people, admittedly like me, people who have the option of a hairstyle that will not attract attention, that will not come across as any kind of statement, it's a bind that might be really hard to imagine.
No, there is no neutral. Like, you know, when Ayanna Pressley had her Senegalese twist, some perceived her as militant. Now she's bearing her beautiful bald head and she's still being perceived away. Like when my hair is straight, there are some people who react to me as if I am like suddenly more docile or prissy or a lot prettier. When it is curly and wild, I have been perceived as militant and angry. Black women, a Dove Crown research study last year found that Black women's hair is 3.5 times more likely to be perceived as unprofessional. And 80% of Black women feel they need to change their hair to fit in at work. It's like nothing we do. Like if I wear braids, I'm spectacle. When my hair is straight, people have questions. How long did that take? Is that all of your hair? Because when we straighten our hair, it's longer than it is when it's natural often. So is that your hair? How long did it take? It's always a spectacle.
I am curious that whether you find that where you are geographically makes a difference in terms of how that pressure is felt. Like, did you feel differently about all of this in Kansas City than you do now in Boston?
There are differences in Boston and Kansas City, but it's a different type of difference. Like, in Kansas City, I had more hate mail and death threats and just people who hated me so much because I was Black and woman and used my looks often against me. Here, that does not happen as much, but I still do deal with people saying things like I didn't recognize you, or how long did that take, or wow, or, you know, the backhanded compliments. I wish I could do that to my hair, those kinds of things. I could never do that.
Call 816-235-2888 with your stories about learning to love your hair, possibly being discriminated against because of your hair. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll pick right back up where we left off after the break. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. We're talking about hair discrimination. I'm joined by Michelle Whatley, the founder of Shirley's Kitchen Cabinet. That's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that's been driving momentum behind the Crown Act in Kansas. We've also got former Kansas City columnist Janae Osterhelt on the line from Boston, and we'll be taking your calls very shortly at 816-235-2888. Let's first talk to Emily Brown. She has a really intense story to tell. Emily, we'll back up and hear the bigger story of how and why you decided to go natural. But for now, I want to hear what happened to you professionally as a result in 2016.
Yes, thank you for having me here today. Well, in 2016, I was invited to speak at a national conference. And this was actually kind of the first time that I had this opportunity within my organization. And so one of the board members at that time pulled me aside after a meeting and said, you know, this is a great opportunity. You know, I think you're smart. This is great. But I'm concerned, you know, that people in the room may not fully hear you because of your hair. You should consider straightening your hair, you know, before you take this trip. And honestly, when she mentioned it, I was kind of taken aback. You know, it was kind of came out of left field, because at that point I'd been natural for several years. I had kind of worked through all my feelings about my hair and had kind of really embraced it, but it really made me think twice on my decision to wear my hair natural. And of course it made me doubt, like, well, are people not listening to me here in rooms in Kansas City because of this hair? Like, you know, it really made me doubt. But ultimately, you know, I just told the board member that I would consider it. And then obviously I did not end up straightening my hair. Mentioned this to the board president at the time, who encouraged me to continue wearing my hair natural. And I should note that this person is no longer on the board of my organization. And we do have, you know, non-discrimination policies and do not stand for this. But, you know, it was very hurtful. And it really, you know, really made me question, you know, am I accepted in this space?
When you sort of wrestled with what you'd been told, what can you tell me more about the thought process that led you to the choice of keeping your hair exactly the way it was?
You know, it really made me think very deeply, you know, kind of about my feelings about my hair and my identity. And, you know, I'd been wearing my hair natural for a while. And I remember having a conversation with my husband, who had been very supportive of my hair and was like, you know, you should just show up as you, like, be you. And if it's good enough for, you know, the meetings that you're going to locally, you know, you've made all of this progress. Obviously, the people who've invited you to speak, you know that this is how you look. Like, it shouldn't be a problem. And so really, you know, I had conversations with my husband. I had a conversation with the president of the board, and ultimately just decided that, you know, it was okay But I really did wrestle because it really made me doubt, you know, like if this one person is questioning this, how many other people have had thoughts and just not said anything? It really did cast doubt in my mind.
What did the hair that you had been asked to straighten mean to you at that juncture in your life? You mentioned that you had made the decision a while back to let your hair go natural, but that was still a decision at one point.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I had, you know, just like Michelle and everyone else who's commented, it's been a journey to get to this point. And I had made a decision to go natural in 2009. And so at this point, I had been natural for several years. You know, I had already, you know, given birth to two daughters who I was raising, you know, to love and accept their own natural hair. And so, you know, there are all of these thoughts of like, you know, I'm always conscious that my girls are watching, you know, because I didn't see a mother embrace her natural hair. You know, my mother had always had beautiful hair, but she, you know, she always straightened it. And she, you know, she did not really see curly hair as beautiful hair. And so I had kind of accepted that and was trying to show that to my girls. And so then to have that experience, it was really just kind of a jolt of, you know, that there are people that still believe that this is not professional hair, that straight is professional, that straight hair is beautiful hair. And I think these are the issues that all Black women wrestle with.
Will you just say a little bit more about what it means to raise your own daughters to love their natural hair?
You know, it's important, I think, for, you know, for my girls to embrace themselves, to love themselves as they are. And so I, you know, try to be very conscious about modeling that for them and, you know, embracing my hair in its natural state and, you know, not obsessing about, you know, being thin and like, you know, all of those things that, you know, we deal with as women in our identity and particularly as a Black woman in America, where, you know, the standard of beauty is not seen as, you know, what we look like. And so just really, you know, trying to show them images of, you know, beautiful, strong Black women who are fully embracing themselves. You know, I have an 8-year-old and an almost 6-year-old. She'll be 6 next week. And so I'm very conscious of it. And my second grader already has experienced, I wouldn't say discrimination, but, you know, there's not a lot of African-American girls in her school. It's a predominantly Hispanic school. And, you know, this pressure to have straight ponytails is there already, even though, you know, I'm walking around with, you know, my curls out every day.
Yeah, you don't get to choose all the pressures that exist even when you're modeling what you think is right.
Right. You know, and so she's already, you know, I remember for the last picture day, she really, really wanted to have her hair in a ponytail because, you know, my girls wear their hair in braids because that's what keeps it, helps it grow and easy to maintain. And so, you know, I let her put it in the ponytails and she comes home and she's upset because, you know, another girl at school said that they're not ponytails, that they were pigtails because they were, you know, because the curls, and all she wanted was to look like the other girls. And so, you know, we don't choose all the pressures, and just knowing that my kids are going to see, you know, they're going to feel pressures from all angles, from the media, from, you know, other kids at school, from, you know, just from everywhere, basically just living. And so I think that it's important, you know, to model acceptance, even in a world that is not screaming that it accepts you, which is why, you know, things like Hair Love are so important. And, you know, for it to win the Oscar is such a win for Black love, you know, Black hair acceptance. It's huge.
Let's talk to a caller. We've got Vince in Waldo on the line. Hi, Vince.
Hey, how you doing? I want to offer a male perspective. As a heterosexual male, I say I grew up around hair culture, beauty shop, but wanting to get the girls' attention, and I'm dating myself, I got a Jerry curl. Chemical burn occurred because of that, and then I had to cut it bald. Now, we're talking about the late 80s, the early 90s. It wasn't in. And so it wasn't until Michael Jordan started, you know, flexing the bald head that now it was cool. Unfortunately, my journey has become more historical because I saw a picture of Frederick Douglass. And anybody see a picture? It looks like a nappy afro, but it made me get into him as a person. And so now I have a daughter and a son, and that's been the push for me, is to study your history and not concentrate so much upon your physical looks, especially your hair. And from a male perspective, it has been a challenge because now I see if my son, he's a young black male, if he has dreads, he's going to be perceived as, perceived as a thug. My girl, because of media, she wants to, you know, braid, straighten out. And, you know, I've been kind of pushing the natural, but my key has really been the pushing and understanding of history. And that's been the key in kind of helping not so much focus on the hair. But yeah, it's definitely been a challenge from a male perspective as well, a black male perspective as well.
Thank you so much, Vince.
With black men.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that story. And Michelle, you were talking about sort of channeling history as part of your own experience of all of this.
Yeah, because again, hair for us is not just hair. It's racial. It's a racial characteristic. It's political. And in the current landscape where we are seeing increasing racism, it becomes even more important. And there's a heightened sense of what it means to bring your full self to public spaces, but what it means to suffer the consequences for bringing your full self to public spaces. So a bill like Senate Bill 250 that was introduced by Senator Fossil Gadeau of Kansas, or the House Bill 2530, who was introduced by Representative Susan Ruiz, who is of Latina descent, becomes ever more important because in a space where racism has again increased and has become kind of front and center, our hair is not only a political statement and a statement of our culture, but laws like this can help to ensure that we can bring our full selves without consequence, because that's the major issue here, right? The fact that people are not allowed to graduate, to participate, and to contribute to the larger society, all because of restrictive hair practices, policies that outline dreads, locks, and braids only impact black people, or policies that say that hair has to be neat and professional impact black people, and essentially becomes a proxy for racism, whether an employee is doing it intentionally or not.
Let's talk to Suzetta, calling us from Kansas City. Hi, Suzetta.
Hello.
What do you want to share?
I am a diversity consultant, and you would think that since I'm presenting information about inclusion, that I wouldn't have the same struggle in my head about whether to wear my hair natural or not. But the conversation I had with myself was whether or not, as a facilitator, encouraging people to think about inclusion and their own behavior, whether I would be perceived as the typical angry black woman. And I was concerned about whether I would be perceived as a professional. And I thought it was interesting that I would have that kind of conversation. You would think that I would not be concerned about that. But we all do. We all think about whether or not our professionalism would be hit negatively, depending on how we look. I quickly got over that dilemma and thought that it would be part of the lesson. It would be part of the demonstration that as a facilitator, my hair would not have anything to do with how well I presented these concepts and information. And that would be a part of the awareness along with the lessons about inclusion.
So you actually asked people acknowledge your hair during the presentations on diversity?
Sometimes I would use my own journey about that as a part of the conversation. Yes, I did.
Did you ever have uncomfortable experiences as a result of that, or did you find it to be pretty successful and mind opening?
It wasn't difficult. In fact, it allowed people to share their own conversations that they've had with other people about hair. In fact, often I think a lot of the African-American women will relate to this. People want to touch your hair, which, you know, yes. that's an invasion of your yeah. personal space. So when people bring that up and say, well, so-and-so was a little annoyed that I wanted to touch your hair, I was just curious. Well, it's like touching a pregnant woman's stomach. That's your personal space. So it allowed us to talk about situations that might have been uncomfortable otherwise, yes. had I not opened that line of communication.
Suzetta, thank you so much for that call. I want to go quickly to Rose in Kansas City, who has a different perspective. Hi, Rose.
Hi. Hi. How are you today?
Good. Tell your story.
Okay. Okay. Real quickly, very briefly, it's not so much my story. First of all, I want to say I'm African-American woman. I'm really bothered by this whole conversation because I think it lacks a component of honesty. First of all, I keep hearing the term natural hair and hair, the terms natural hair and hair love, when in fact all of us have to be aware of the fact that we are not walking around in natural hair. We are adding like pounds and hair that is like 2 and 3 yards long to our head so that we can have a certain look. That is not natural. Natural is exactly what you came here with.
Rose, I don't mean to hurry you along, but we don't have much time, and I know that you have a point to make about your choice to straighten your own hair and thinking that that should be okay, too.
You know, that's not my position. I don't straighten my hair. I'm not sure where that came from, but I don't straighten my hair. But I do want to add something very quickly. I'll be very brief. It's something for us to consider is that we have children that have hair added on. It's braided. It's beaded. The children are sleeping on hardware. And also the fact that weave also causes damage, even in the form of braids, because it's pulling at your scalp. And you go in restaurants and people have hair hanging down their back, and even if they're braids and they're calling it natural. So those are issues. And I think that we need to kind of look at some self-love a little bit harder and say maybe I don't even need to add things and just be natural, be exactly what you're saying, and go with the natural hair.
All right,
so
Rose.
That's my point.
I'm going to let Janae Osterheld respond to both of these calls we just heard about the complexity of what we even mean with our terms and the nuance of who experiences this and how, that it might be a lot more complicated under the surface than it even appears just in the final choice that a person makes. Janae?
Hi, I'm going to try. I know we're running short on time. So what I'll say is Miss USA, Miss America, Miss Teen USA, Miss Universe, and Miss World are all Black women. One of them has very long, wavy, curly hair. One of them has a beautiful, short, cropped, natural, almost buzz cut. One of them has braids with the extensions. One of them straight flat irons her hair. And the other one has a short, lush, beautiful, coily afro. And I think what it's important to remember is it's not, yes, when we say natural, a lot of us mean that our hair, as it grows out of our head, the beautiful way in which it sits and grows up and out. But it also means identifiably Black styles, braided styles, the silk press, which Kim Kardashian calls glass hair, but it actually is a Black style called a silk press, cornrows, all of these things. And yes, some of these styles can be damaging if not done in a healthy way, but a lot of them can be done in a healthy way. And I think it's important that Black people, women, girls, men, them, boys, however you identify, are able to show up and be their unapologetic selves, whether we add, subtract, cut, or whatever, without being so politicized and dehumanized. And that's my answer to both of them.
Okay. We have to leave it there. Keep telling your stories on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Michelle Whatley, Janae Osterheld, Emily Brown, thank you all so much. Up next, abandoned buildings and water slides, all kinds of things. Stay with us. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now we're talking about a book of photographs called Abandoned Kansas City. The author and photographer Regina Daniel is here to talk about the project. She's an urban explorer. And Regina, what does that mean, urban explorer?
That just means that we as a group, we seek out abandoned buildings that have been just left empty, and we just go exploring and photograph. And for me, and I don't know about other explorers, but for me, I also like to put some history and some story behind it, because each of these places do have an in-depth story and history behind them.
Your premise is basically that our city has kind of boomed and our infrastructure has been expanding and expanding over the decades, but especially recently, and that these abandoned places show another side of progress.
Yes. 2015, when the Royals won the World Series, it was a really big game changer for us, and it really put Kansas City on the map. People were realizing what a great city we have, how inexpensive it is to live here, and at that point, the mayor, you know, I guess got a fire under him, and just buildings were starting to be demolished left and right. But and there was a lot that went down between 2016 to 2018.
Yeah, a lot of these places in your book are very recently abandoned. And an example of that, this would be on the Kansas side, actually, the Rosedale Ridge Apartments. We did a whole show on that. It was a controversial thing. The complex included a lot of low-income housing. It was shut down because the conditions were deemed unsafe, unlivable. Everyone pretty much agreed on that piece of it. But when everyone moved out, a whole community had to disperse. What did you see when you went back in after that space was very quickly evacuated and boarded up?
When I was in grade school in the early, mid-80s, I actually had friends that we went to elementary school together that lived there. So I actually got to see it, you know, back in the 80s when it was a full complex of families and there was a playground in the courtyard and everything. And to go back when I did, it was post-apocalyptic, I guess you could say. It was just, there had been things left behind. There were like fluorescent colored city notices all over the place, and you can still see how there was still black mold there. And it was just, it was a real shame, and in a somewhat of a blessing in disguise for certain people who lived in one of the buildings where 9 months after everybody was forced to move out by the city, there was a gas leak that blew up one of the buildings that has now, it's now just an empty space there, but it just kind of seemed like it was one tragedy after another with that apartment complex. And I'm glad that the people have moved on to bigger, better things where somebody will care about them, because the management that was running that place did not care with the multitude of problems that they had.
You've been in a lot of schools, and I want to talk about your first school exploring experience.
Greenwood. I was actually really sad to see that one go because it was my first school. But Greenwood, it sits on the corner where the first city, pedestrian underground crossing still is. It is closed up, but the underground crossing is still there. But the first school that... Greenwood. It was just amazing to see the curtains still hanging in the auditorium, the pencil sharpeners still on the wall. Some of the hallways still had like all the equipment, like the Xerox machines. There were pallets of shrink wrap computers from 1997 still like shrink wrapped on pallets still there.
You were in a time capsule.
It definitely is a time capsule. Each place pretty much is, because there's always something left behind that dates it.
There's a detail in a lot of these school photographs that is sort of idiosyncratic, and I think the rope swings, the climbing ropes in the gyms, they're all still there. Like in school after school. And I think that if you don't enter boarded up abandoned buildings ever, like I don't do that, what I picture in my mind, logical or not, is that it's empty in there. They're not empty. They just sort of stopped time and put boards up.
Yes, that's very much the case in many of the places I go, in addition to schools. I've been in offices and other buildings where like equipment and office stuff has been left, but it kind of just seems when people are done with the building and or school, they just kind of close it up and call it a day.
There is a water slide in this book, and that intrigued me. Just your whole story of first noticing the water slide and then kind of researching, crowdsourcing to try and figure out what's the deal with this big, big slide that's got like weeds climbing up over it.
Yeah. That one, it took me some time to find. I actually had to depend on social media, which I try not to do too often to
get my... Why not?
Because you just get approximates. You don't get your absolute answers. You get people that just guess, oh, I worked there or I went there at this such and such time. And I remember last going there such and such date. But you don't really get the definitive answers as to when and why.
And you do kind of get that when you go on your own feet to a physical place?
Yes. If it is a historic building, the National Register of Historic Places are very, very informative, where I get a lot of my details to the history. But when I do have to depend on social media, I like what comes of it. I just don't depend on it on a regular basis. I like it because then you kind of get to see memories unfold. People were like, oh, yeah, I worked there. It was so fun. And oh, my God, I used to go there all the time. It was so great.
So this water slide, what's the deal?
It was for me to find that. Like, I couldn't just research a water slide in Kansas City because Schlitterbahn was the only thing that kept coming up. So that's when I kind of had to. It's got a Kansas City address, but I kind of put it out there in the Grandview and Belton crowd. And I mean, the responses just came flooding in about it was Pepe's Slip and Slide. And it just had the one slide. There was an arcade. A lot of people who worked there chimed in. A lot of people who spent their summers going there.
What does it look like now?
It's a very deep, high walls to this slide, and it's all concrete. So just being there, I was like, oh my God, people used to go down this concrete slide for fun. I'm surprised people didn't get like shredded up. But as the comments came in, there were a lot of people that were like, oh, I used to love going there, but man, the slide would so shred my legs up and stuff.
I want to say you have an interest, like a long-standing interest in horror movies as well. And you went back to a hotel where you'd attended a horror convention after it too became an abandoned place, which seems like almost like adding to the creepy piece of this.
That hotel, actually, it was just a bevy of weirdness because in addition to the horror movie convention that was taking place there annually, they also hosted swingers conventions there as well. But that hotel has a very special place in my heart because I used to attend it when it was open and we would stay there and I got married there. During the horror convention, we had Ernie Hudson, the Ghostbuster, give me away.
Oh, my God.
And so to see this hotel where I got married and all these friends blossomed and then just to see it left. And I mean, I was there from before it closed, the week it closed, the second week it closed. And it only took 2 weeks for everything to start. The vandalism, the scrappers coming in, stripping everything down. Shortly, like 2 weeks after I was the first time I was in there, they even found a dead man in the elevator shaft from scrapping.
So that is that's like the far end of on the spectrum of joyous discovery to not so joyous. That's in the not so joyous. But what joy do you take? Presumably, you go in and explore these places by choice. There's something that you emerge with that means something really important to you.
Preservation. It's about, even though my pictures show these buildings in multiple stages of decay, it's still preservation of this is what it looked like here, then the next day, and so on and so on. So the joy for me is about the preservation.
Regina Daniel, thank you so much. Before you go, any advice to people who, or warnings even, who think they might be up for trying urban exploring? Because you have some ground rules for yourself.
I do. I never go alone. I always have a partner or two with me. Make sure you have good lighting, good shoes, because there are risks of, you know, falling through a floor or stepping on a nail, but never go alone.
Regina's book is Abandoned Kansas City. Check it out. Our time is up, but you can listen to anything we talked about today at kcur.org/centralstandard. The majority of the hour we focused on hair discrimination, and we've been talking right now about urban exploring and the abandoned spaces of Kansas City. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST and talk to us there about potholes. We're thinking about talking about that tomorrow. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.